Welcome to the Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast. For thousands of years, the sages have known that compassion is a powerful force for good. In the last two decades, compassion scholars caught up with these sages, proving that there is an ROI to building loving communities and businesses. This podcast features leaders who can teach us about the power of compassion. Hello, I'm Laurel Donnellan. I am the founder and chief operating officer at Compassionate Leaders Circle. Welcome to our podcast, and I'm here with my dear friend and co-host, Daryl Brown. And we're so excited and honored because we are so lucky to have Christian Nunes with us. She is the president of NOW. Christian, welcome.
Thank you so much, Laurel and Daryl, for having me on your show today.
We're so excited. So I've read a lot about you and your history and the history of the organization. And I want to go back a bit because I was thinking about my own history around feminism. And I'm proud to say that my great grandmother and grandmother were suffragettes in Chicago, Illinois. And they're smiling down on me today with you. So I'm curious about your own journey as a woman, as a feminist in your family. Like, what brought you to this work?
So it's such an interesting story because I always tell everyone that I never really used the term feminist or for myself and identity until probably in my 30s. But I feel like I was raised in a family full of feminists, you know, and a lot of the value systems of feminism, we always supported and stood strong, but we just never really identified as feminists. And I think that's very common for Black families and Black women throughout time. You know, I was raised in a very matriarchal, strong family. We always believed in our equality. It was always taught. My mother raised me and my brothers to believe that we could do whatever we wanted to do. And we were on equal ground. And I got exposure to NOW in grad school in 2001 from a Campus Action Network chapter at Columbia University. I just really didn't fully engage in it, but I went to a couple of different events they had, and it resonated with me then, like, okay, this aligns with me, you know, what's going on. But still at that point, I still didn't really call myself a feminist. I supported feminism and the ideologies of feminism. And then as I grew older and just started going into the workforce after graduate school, I think that's where actually calling myself a feminist became more, as a priority and pronounced in what I did. But feminism has always been in my background. It's always been ingrained in how I was raised, you know. It's kind of just like we were raised that way. And I think so it's very natural progression and getting involved in NOW at the local level. My Arizona was where I was at, and then the state level, and then the national board. I wound up becoming vice president and then president. But so it's been a wonderful journey. It's been a challenging journey, but it's also a very great journey of being able to really speak out and talk about feminism and for this new generation's fourth wave.
So we have the honor here of teaching young people about compassionate leadership. And I feel like one of the things that you could tell us about that could help them is your educational journey, because I think I counted 3 degrees, right?
Yes.
Tell us about your education and how your education supports you now in this big role you have.
Absolutely. Well, I'm a self-proud social worker. I always tell everyone. So I actually started in social work and my bachelor's in social work. And I really focused on violence prevention work and advocacy for women and girls and children. just in general and children. And that's kind of how I started the whole victim advocacy framework. And then I took a year off and worked before going to grad school. I postponed my admission for a year just to work. And while I was working, I worked as a victim advocate, and I worked with a victim advocate, domestic violence advocate, but also in the juvenile court system. But I always intentionally planned on becoming a mental health therapist. That was the goal, because growing up, you know, also just seeing that in Black communities and in my communities, I lived in predominantly, sometimes predominantly Black communities and sometimes predominantly white communities. But I always felt like there really wasn't anybody that I resonated with that could understand, like, maybe the journeys I had of being the only Black child in class, or the experiences I had in my own personal community, depending on where we lived. So that was a key for me, that I wanted to go to mental health. And so then I went ahead and went and got my master's in social work for Columbia University, and focused on clinical practice and mental health, health and disabilities. And then I came out and started working as a therapist, started my own practice in the community, and also did some contracting work to help different groups and orgs with their behavioral health plans and conflict cooperative work and policies. And then I went back to school and got my master's in business administration, because I felt that was one area at that time they lacked to teach us as social workers, is the business side of things and how to navigate and how to, you know, understand the business framework. So then I went back and got my master's and bachelor's, my MBA, and focus really a lot on strategy. And so that's been really helpful to me, I think, having those both frames of understanding how people are directly impacted working in community as a community organizer, as a therapist, but then also having the MBA that really helped me learn about, you know, strategy and policy and things like that. And putting those two together has been really helpful in this role as the national president for now. I'm able to really understand both sides of the side of where people are at, where victims were at, where people who are oppressed are at, but also understanding the need of how do we create policy and programming to best fit their needs.
I talk to a lot of MBAs, very few MBAs that also have a degree in social work, but I think many of the leaders I talk to wish they had a degree in social work, because the people side of every business, whether it's a huge not-for-profit or a tech company, mm-hmm. is always a surprise to them how much time they spend on people. So.
Yeah, because a lot of times we're dealing with people, personalities, right? And everything we do. I mean, even what we're witnessing right now that's happening in this world, in Congress, the issues that are going on, the effects of COVID, the effect of gun violence, the effects of abortion bans, people are affected directly emotionally, you know, and psychologically. So if we're not willing to understand that part of the whole person, how can we be really effective in creating policies and programmings that really help? We have to understand the whole person, understand every aspect of them, and not piecemeal them in order to be able to officially serve them.
Before I pass you over to my colleague, Daryl, I know that one of the big shifts at NOW is from focusing entirely on gender to what you call intersectionality. Mm-hmm. Could you define that for us? And then Daryl will take over the interview.
Sure. Well, I love talking about intersectionality. And I will say, actually, now it's very interesting. I like to bring this up because our history is really based in intersectionality before it was even coined a term, because our co-founders were a mix of Black women and white women and a few Latino women who and some men, but our primary co-founders came together at a time during the civil rights movement where there was, you know, gender injustice, gender discrimination, for sex discrimination for women, as well as racial discrimination is happening. So some of our amazing co-founders came together at this time to find a place where they could address both issues. It's always say NOW's history has always really truly been this intersectionality. But if we talk about it more defined, you know, we know Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw was the original one who defined intersectionality, and she's amazing. But it really talks about really truthfully how different levels of our societal factors that influence us and influence different women differently. So, and how that deals with also the types of oppression we may experience and discrimination we experience based on our identities and the different social factors we may experience. So those might be race, it could be ethnicity, it could be our socioeconomic status, it could be what part of the country we live in, our sexuality or our ability. So if I, as a Black woman, you know, I'm a Black woman, I'm a cisgender heterosexual female, but because I'm just a Black woman, doesn't mean I have the same experience as maybe a Black lesbian woman who is, you know, in a that's living in certain types of areas. So we have different experiences, and that level of oppression continuously rises based on the different factors based on where you are. So we both could be from poverty, but if I'm a person of color, I'm going to also experience more oppression and discrimination because of that. That is really truly what intersectional feminism is talking about, is that we can't isolate it and silo the work we're doing. We have to look at how those different factors impact a person's sense of equality and justice in this world.
Thank you. Daryl?
Well, you really just hit on an area that I find so it's so impactful on policy,
mm-hmm.
right? Because if you don't understand how the many layers of oppression work,
mm-hmm.
you take your eye off, you kind of take your eye off the ball, and you can
absolutely
you can concentrate on one area. And then all of a sudden that person, and I'm so impressed by your mental health work.
Thank you.
All right, because that's really where it hits. And I'd like for you to talk more about the mental health aspect of it and how the series of oppression feelings come down on one's mental health, because mental health is behind so many things that are wrong with our society right now.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if we just look at what happened this week with Raph Jarl and the young women that turned around in the driveway and was shot to death, and both of them just attacked victims of senseless gun violence. But we also have to also look at what was going on with the mental health of the people who, you know, how they looked at those things and how they, those perpetrators and aggressors. But when we're talking about the oppression, so I think, we have to look at it holistically. We have to look at the people who are spitting vitriol, spitting hate, spitting violence. And we also have to look at the impact of trauma and the impact of racialized trauma, racialized violence and oppression on people who are experiencing it every single day. I mean, can you imagine the chronic trauma and stress that occurs when not only are you dealing with poverty, but you're also dealing with, so you're struggling to find, you know, to be able to afford the world. You're still making minimum wage since 2009, you know, you're also experiencing forms of racial microaggressions every day in your workplace, as a person of color. So you have the poverty where you're not really able to fully live, you know, and have a safe and sustainable life. You have the low income that keeps you in a wage gap as a woman. Then you have the racialized, right, microaggressions of people who say things like, well, you can do it. You just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Or if you worked harder, if your people did this, I mean, there is so many levels. You put that all together, it really compounds the sense of helplessness, despair, which actually is part of the goal of the oppressor, right? It's to put that despair so strong that we are mentally weakened, we're emotionally weakened, and we're disadvantaged. So we have to look at all that stuff together to understand how mental health is directly related to everything that's happening within this world and everything that's happening within the violence, the response, the health of our bodies, everything, it's all intertwined with mental health. And we can't discard that when we're working on our solutions. We have to look at it is how are we addressing this whole person? How are we acknowledging and validating the multiple layers of stress they have that are contributing to anxiety and depression and hypervigilance and living in fear? Those are major things. And if we neglect that, we are disadvantaging ourselves for creating a world that's safe for everyone.
So it's obvious that it has been neglected in the past. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think we have to look at a couple of things. I think part of it is looking at who we're electing into office, right? The people we elect into office and what their priorities are and what their values and beliefs are. I think the other part is that generally in this world, you know, especially United States more than anything, we are very like an individualistic society. So we tend to just focus on, you know, we've moved a shift to it. I think at one time we were more community, but right now we've been very individualistic where it's really about what I need to do for me and nothing else. And not really taking the time to think about the impact of our behaviors or our work or our actions on another person. And then I think also it's just the fact that people just not taking, and this is where we have the institutional racism in our country, that they just don't value a lot of people as whole people in general, right? I mean, women, we're still fighting for equal rights amendment to be included in the Constitution 100 years later, right? Now we're seeing that many countries, and many places are fighting for reproductive rights, especially in the United States. We're seeing this new generation have less rights than in their grandmothers did. We're seeing that people have less voting rights, right, than they had in 1965 when they first started the fight for it. So as we see this regression happening, we have to look at whose values are leading this policy, whose values are leading the work that we're doing, the funding, everything. And that's a big place where we as advocates and we as activists can make a change, is encouraging community-based collective power, again, as well as encouraging people to choose wisely and research who they're electing into office to get more involved in politics. So they understand who they're putting in office has a direct impact on their suffering or their healing in everyday life.
You know, so you spoke a little bit about activism, and we have we do deal with a lot of teens and young people. So what would you say to them to encourage them to be more active and get involved in things that would really make a difference?
Well, I want to first just acknowledge this new generation, Gen Z and Gen Alpha, I believe this is the last one coming out. I know we're going back in time, right? Are just a very amazing activist. They are leading the way and they're authentically and unapologetically leading the way. They're looking at it from an intersectional perspective, looking at it from racial justice. So I want to first give them credit and their flowers for the work that they're doing. But then what I would also just continue to encourage them is to understand that they are our future. They are our legacy. They are the ones who are going to decide how to deal and fix and save democracy and fix and save this world. So, and they all have value. It doesn't matter if what you may not be strong in this area, but you have something to contribute. I'm a big believer in asset building, which is basically using everyone's asset to get to our common goal. Like, we may not all have the same strength, but I have some asset that I can give to fix this. And I just encourage young people to think about that, is to think about, you have something to contribute. You have something to say that will impact somebody. It doesn't matter if it's one person, it doesn't matter if it's 15 or 15,000. The ability to impact one person can then have that person's inability to impact 10,000. So I just encourage them to continue to hold truthful to themselves. No, they don't have to have it all figured out, but they have something to say and we want them to say it. We want them to lead. And so just continue to lead and stay truthful to themselves and their leadership.
I hear a lot of self-awareness in what you say, because without that, that's really where you find your passion.
Absolutely.
And where you're able to contribute is what you're most passionate about. Mm-hmm. And when I hear you talk, I hear that passion in your voice. So that's how you get things done.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so important because, like, what do they always say? Like, you have to learn to love yourself and understand yourself before you can understand or love anybody else, right? So that's why I think self-awareness is so important, because it keeps us challenging ourselves. It keeps us assessing ourselves about even our own biases, right? Because we all have biases too. And really where we're guided and what's important to us. And because when we work in that passion, we work in that purpose, we are intentional about it. We are assertive about it. We don't back down, you know? And so I think that's all we have to find a way to get back to working purposefully in our work that we do every day.
So you also spoke about policy and grassroots policy, right? I mean, that starts at the grassroots level.
Absolutely.
School board level. You are involved in things that advocate involvement in the school board level. Can you tell us a little more about that?
So one of the great things is now advocates for national, state, and local policies, right? We are grassroots at the grassroots course. So we really are working toward promoting like anti-racist and intersectional feminist agendas at every single level. But I think it's important that we also understand that in that we have to start like hyper-local in the work that we're doing with our grassroots work, because those are the things that directly are having an impact on the everyday life. So now we have a national office, we also have state chapters, and we have local chapters. I think we have over like 300 local chapters, right, throughout the United States. And we have some chapters in other countries as well. But what we have to do in that work is then understand that every part of policy, no matter if it's at the school level, or it's a city council, or it's a water commission, you know, our corporation commission, a secretary of state, all the way up to Congress, it has extreme importance in the impact of our daily lives and what's affecting us, especially more local than anything, right? Because those local ordinances, local policies, they impact you every single day. You're living those. It's in your state. And then when we move up, you know, up and up, you know, who we are also working and putting in those places can make a difference between book bans we're seeing right now, right? We look at the school board. Those individuals on the school board who are promoting, you know, the anti-woke movement or banning books or getting rid of, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion trainings and work, that's because they were elected and they don't have a value in those things. So it's so important on the grassroots level that we work hard to replace those people, right? Get them out. We need people in who are going to be in alignment with our issues, our approach to equality and equity, and people who are going to work against inequitable systems in this country. It can't happen by itself. It can't happen only in the local level. It can't happen only in the state level. And it definitely can't happen on the only federal level. It has to happen like simultaneously on all three levels in order to really, truly fight the injustice and inequities that we're seeing in this country.
You know the old saying, it takes a village.
Absolutely.
To move things. So I'd like for you to talk about some of the other groups that you look to join with in order to fight this effort.
Sure. So I always like to say that we could not, now as our national office is small but mighty, right? but we couldn't do this work without coalition building and coalition partnerships. It's impossible. It's impossible, I think, for any org, this fight that we're in, this determination for equity and inclusion, we cannot do this by ourselves. This is impossible. You know, we're not experts in every field. We are not fully equipped. We have people who have wonderful things to bring and experiences to bring. And so we have to align with like-minded coalitions who also value the same issues we value, the same beliefs we could value on in intersectionality and anti-racism and equity and equality. We have to go align with those organizations that do that. So we are very intentional about, we have 6 core issues. Our core issues are racial justice, ending violence against women, economic justice, reproductive rights and justice, constitutional equality, and LGBTQIA plus rights. And in those rights, we have to align with coalition partners and other orgs that there's their primary focus and expertise, so that we are diligently giving out the right information and doing what's right work and letting them lead, I could say too, because we can't lead every movement now, can't, right? We can lead some, but we can't lead all of them. So we have to rely on the coalition partnerships to make sure that we are advocating and pushing legislation and policy that is really going to work. And the more we are together, like you said, a village takes a village, more coalitions come together, more partnerships come together, we're able to put more pressure to move things. So we work with, I mean, I probably would say over 50 different coalition partners in different areas, from voting rights to reproductive rights to economic justice to ERA, constitutional. I mean, we just work with many coalition partners, and we're part of many coalitions as well.
So you've been head of NOW since 2020, and so many things have happened since then. There is such great backlash. In my opinion, you know, since Obama was elected and went through their backlash, there has been a severe move to the right that attacks all of the groups that you're talking about. With all of that being said, how do you take care of yourself individually? Because it's out there. I'd love to know how you take care of yourself as in your leadership role.
Yeah, you know, and it's so funny, Daryl. I had this question with someone this week about how we continue to have our self-care in this process, because you're hearing, you're dealing with so many like very traumatic and intense, you know, issues every single day. And for me, you know, I'm a very spiritual person. I really enjoy family life. So I have to like compartmentalize at times to separate the two. And when I stop working and turn to my family, I have to turn to my family and my son. And when I need that push, I pray, I read the Bible, I listen to gospel, I meditate, I listen to meditation music. You know, I do a mix of things to help me personally stay focused and not get like frustrated or get overwhelmed. Those are the things I have to use for myself. And I think everyone has to find their own sense of peace and things that peace tools and things that bring them peace so that they continue to feel like refilled in this work we're doing. Cause it can be draining, right? Sometimes we all get like so drained. We're like, oh my goodness, one more thing, you know? So we have to find a way to tap into our own peace tools so we can continue the self-care and then having a relationship with people who check me too. Like I have great friends who say, okay, now you're doing too much, you need to take a break, you know, and then I do that for them. And that's very helpful to have people in my village that are very supportive and understanding, because I'm doing this. And I will say too, I'm also a single mother to a toddler. I have a 3-year-old, he'll be 4 next month. So in this process of doing this role, you know, I'm raising very hyper loving tall 3-year-old Black boy. but he also guides my passion for making sure this work is happening. But we have to, when it's our time, it's mommy and son time, it's mommy and son time, and work is to interfere. And when it's time with my friends, it's time with my friends. So I try to separate it and cut it off, understanding I can't do everything, but I have to take care of myself or otherwise I won't be good to anybody at all.
And it takes the effort that it takes to connect to especially Black boys. Mine are 18 and 21 now. And I think it never fades. It just changes. It just changes.
So it evolves in something.
Yeah, it's really true. It's really true. So to keep your eye on that and on all of the good things that you're doing, so thank you very much. When it comes to racial justice, I live in Texas. Texas is under attack.
Absolutely.
Right. Do you concentrate more in individual places like a Texas or a Florida or an Arizona coming up?
So we don't, I guess it depends on what issues are happening at the time. You know, we, like I said, we have state chapters who are really extremely focused on the issues happening in their states. And then when those issues become switched over to national, the national office may step in and also advocate, and we'll support our state chapters and local chapters in the work they're doing. But when it comes to elections, we do are intentional about focusing on states like Texas and Arizona, both of which I lived in. I'm from Houston, Texas, originally. I was born there, and then I grew up in Arizona. So it's really interesting to me, too, to see the shifts that have been happening in Arizona in the last year or two. But we have to be intentional when it comes to election seasons and the work we're doing around politics to focus in those states that we're seeing like the most egregious types of bills coming through. And we work really hard and we provide resources to our grassroots advocates in the states to make sure they're equipped with the skills they need and the tools they need to do the work and have access to those resources, because it's so important. Right now, there's a huge push to move towards state legislators and state legislations owning control of all policy and rights for people. And we have to fight that. That is, statehood is not the way to go in the sense of the safety and equity for individuals. Because we know what we're seeing in different states like Texas and Florida. I mean, could you imagine if they were able to make choices and choose their state legislations and policies over federal? It would be damning for many millions of people. So we work really hard with our chapters to help them in those states to push. And when there's things that really call out, we, like Texas, the Mife case, we're really big in that right now. So we do get them when we need to, but we work to support our state and local chapters in those states.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you're also involved in racial justice training.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And can you talk a little bit about that and what you do and how you do it? Because that racial justice training is a very tricky area.
It really is. I think it's, you know, it's definitely in 2019, our membership passed a resolution for anti-racism training and equity training for the whole organization. So understanding that, you know, we have to work on our own internal issues in the organization if we could be effective anti-racist allies. So we really focus on that as like preparing and looking and working through our own, you know, personal things as advocates and activists so that we can be effective in our anti-racist work that we're doing. To say that any org is free from bias or racism, we would be all lying, mm-hmm. right? So we have to be honest about that. And we have to challenge those places where we see within our organization where we're seeing it, you know, create systems of inequality or racial inequity or injustice. And so our work has been to come through and starting with our, you know, national office and our national board and staff is to really put them through an IEI training where they can look at themselves and understand like their own sense of how they see things and where the holdup is and how the organization is, and then analyzing our policies and practices and bylaws. And then moving on to our state and local chapters to have them do it as well, the state leaders, so they understand it as well. Because if they're equipped with the right tools and understanding of where they are, starting out as themselves, their own analysis of it, then they'll be more effective if they're willing to engage in the change and change to be able to be more effective in how they're approaching the work that they're doing in the local and state levels, as well as nationally. So it's kind of very systematic. We're starting off with people being able to really understand where they are, and doing assessments, and we're working with a wonderful group of to do that. And then from that, we have conversations about it, and then have some equity groups, and then we're moving through with trainings and tools that our membership can use and our offices, our national offices can use to push through our work. So you're really being truthful and authentic anti-racist allies. It's a process, though, I will tell you, Daryl. It sounds so easy to say it, but you know, it is some work. Let me tell you, it is, it's been, because I think sometimes part of it too, Laurel and Daryl, is sometimes people feel like, well, I'm an activist, I'm for this. And they think that it means they're immune to having bias. And it's like, oh no, no, no. Let me tell you, that's not how it works. So.
Yeah. And they think they're done once they say that, right?
Right. Like, yeah. And it's like, nope, nope, nope. I have work to do. You have work to do. We all have work to do. We are not done. It's a constant.
Yeah. Yeah. Fortunately, the work doesn't stop.
Right. Exactly. It's constant.
Yeah. Yeah. Daryl and I have been in a conversation as friends for 31 years. And I, every time we're in a conversation about bias, I learn something else about myself.
Yeah. So. And Laurel, at least you're willing to learn, right? That's the best part about it, is the willingness to like say, hey, I just learned something new. And hey, still got to work on this stuff. I think
that wasn't easy. I mean, because I'm from a liberal family and I'm, you know, I have a story about, I've had this whole story that I'm not biased. So it took years to figure out that I am. And it's, you know, I'm constantly, I mean, I'm lucky enough to be in conversations all the time with people who aren't like me. But no matter how old we are or how liberal or, you know, we think we are, there's always something more to learn about ourselves. And I so appreciate that about my conversations with Daryl, my conversations with our guests on this podcast, you know?
Yeah. And I always tell people too, it's like acknowledging your bias doesn't mean that you are racist. It could be, but it doesn't mean necessarily. But it also doesn't mean that you have to have guilt about recognizing your bias, right? We got to recognize our bias so that we can change it. And if we are not willing to recognize it and own it, how can we ever change it and improve it to make this world more equitable and have equality for people and have less, you know, racial and gender and every other type of ability bias that there can exist. So we have to be able to understand that by recognizing our bias and pointing it out is the first step for us in changing.
Well, that self-awareness is what we were talking about mm-hmm. earlier. And, yeah. you know, speaking on that, I'd love to know how you came to understand what you had to do, what your place in society really was. And because it is a leadership role, a lot of people have that, but don't know how to get there.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny because I remember ever since I was a child, 9 years old, I was always like just really had compassion and passion for injustice. Like it was like, I just couldn't stand injustice. It was just, I guess I'm just an old soul, but I never understood injustice. Impartiality, you know, bias, racism, anything that was injustice didn't work for me. And at first I was like, I'm going to be an attorney. I'm going to help people who are experiencing these things, but I didn't really want to go to the court. And I was like, that's not really necessarily what I want to do, but I want to work in injustice. And then I said, well, the first step is maybe to help people. That's when I went to social work. So I did that. And I think throughout the time, what I recognized is that, you know, healing was really important to me. Healing this world is really important to me. Equity was really important to me. And justice was important to me. So whatever work I did, it had to some way deal with those things. It had to some way deal with healing. It had to some way deal with fighting for, you know, equality and equity and fairness. And my own personal life experiences, I think, helped me just push me even further as a Black woman and experiencing those things, experiencing racism, experiencing sexism, experiencing both, you know, experiencing colorism as a dark-skinned Black woman. You know, I mean, it's multiple things that I went through that let me know, okay, yes, Christian, you have to keep pushing on this. You have to keep fighting against these injustices. It's like, you know, this is what you just have to do. And I just continue to do it. Continue to like just use my voice as best as possible.
Yeah. Laurel?
Yeah. So One of the things I got from this discussion, and I thank you so much for all your insights and wisdom, is I like this idea that your vote can create suffering or healing.
Yes.
Like that, I think that can work for all of us.
You know? Absolutely.
And I'm taking that away. I'm taking away your positivity because you have a hard job. And you're very close to all, frankly, the ugliness of our society and changing that. So I thank you for all the peace tools you're using for yourself and your self-care and the positivity and light that you bring to all these things. I'm curious, knowing that we have Gen Z and Gen Alpha coming up, where do you see us as a society? Let's just focus on the US for now, 10 years from now. Like what would you like your son to see when he's 13?
Well, so I would like, especially for my son, which is a great place to start, to be able to live in a world where he feels free to exist. And it's really a simple thing. And I mean that in so many ways. Free to exist, meaning like he can walk down the street, he can play, he can wear what he wants to wear, he can listen to his music, he can have a bad day and have an attitude, but he is free to exist in with safety and nonviolence. Like those things are so crucially important to me. He's free to exist, to make his own decisions, to be his own person. That is where I want to see the future for the Gen Z and the Gen Alphas, that they are free to exist in their own persons. They are free to be who they want to be, how they live, without experiencing, you know, discrimination and violence, without fear. That is so important because right now they're not having that. They're having the opposite, you know, kids are walking out because they're sick, you know, sick of gun violence and people shooting up, mass shootings and school shootings, and they're sick of the racism they're seeing. They're sick of the mistreatment, of being seen as invisible in some areas, of their rights being overturned, taken away. So I think part of our goal, especially with now, is, you know, we have two parts, and one is that is like, how do we engage these Gen Zs and Gen Alphas and millennials to lead us, you know, and work with us right now as we're leading. I don't think it's so much of us passing a baton as it is sharing the baton, and really helping them come up and speak and tell us what we need to do for their generations. I think that's really important. So our goal is to figure out, like, you know, we've been expanding our Campus Action Network chapters. It's been a goal for us, and trying to partner with more other groups with younger Gen Zs and Alphas in it, so we can kind of help start training them in the areas they need training, but also working and getting their inputs in what we're doing for their generations. And then the other part I keep going back is to policy and electing, right? The future of now, our goals, and it's select feminist champions. We have a now PAC political action committee where we endorse federal candidates. And we have another program called Run Now we developed since I started on and took the helm. And that program is to actually provide training for members to run for office or become campaign operatives, because sometimes you're the one working behind, and that's totally fine, right? You don't have to be the person running. But we have to move these people out of the way. We have to move all the oppressors, all the misogynists, all the races. We have to get them out of office because they're determining policy for our lives. And as we clearly see, they don't care about our lives. So we want to make sure we're increasing education, we're putting more feminist champions in policy. And I like to say feminists are not just women, right? Feminists are people who believe in the equality and equity of women and their rights to women to live safe and sustainable lives and to have futures and be protected. So anybody can be a feminist if they believe in that and they're true to that in their behavior and not just their words. So we have to elect more feminist candidates into positions of power so that we're not seeing things like this come up anymore and they're having our issues at hand. And we have to continue to work to educate our community about issues and how they impact their lives, and showing them how they can be empowered in their communities. that's a big part of our job that we have to do. And that's not just bringing them in, it's educating them, training them. It's electing people, it's choosing who we elect, being intentional about who we support. It's having programs and other things available to help people get those resources and tools they need. So we stay in tune and we stay committed to what our purpose is. So I would say that's really where I see the future of NOW moving, continuing to work hard on those things, continue to be truthful in our legislative, get more involved in state lobbying, federal lobbying, things like that, that can really give us a voice and make sure we're representing everyone.
Amazing. Sign me up for that vision. I want to live in that world.
Hey, I want you both to become members. We have not already members. We will both welcome you into membership.
Yeah, definitely. So Christian, tell us about how someone can find their local chapter and tell us about your website and how people can get involved.
Absolutely. You can go to www.nownow.org, and on the first page, there has the place if you kind of scroll down and it says, you know, want to join us, and then, you know, you can join there. And then from there, when you put in your information, it will ask you places about where you live demographically, and it can link you right there when you're setting up to membership to a local chapter or state chapter. If you don't have a local chapter in your city, you'll be more membership at large, which you'll be linked to the state chapters. So that's a great way to get involved on your local level. For national wise, if you just tune to our website, you can see the amazing programs and events that we're having on the national level, the different trainings we offer. We send out a newsletter every week. I send out a newsletter every week to membership and our donors and supporters, where we give them information about what's going on, attach action alerts, different activities, different resources for them, and other supporting articles and information. So that's the way to sign up for our newsletter as well. And you can do that on our front page of our website as well.
And I encourage everyone who's frustrated with things, go to the NOW website and look for solutions and be part of the solution. You could turn your frustration into fighting for justice.
Right. And if you don't want to join, we also take, of course, donations for people who want to support the work we're doing as well. But go to that website. It's very full.
It's amazing.
Lots of things and things to do and information for you.
I mean, I definitely got a sense that you're more than I thought you were. You're kind of handling so many things and so many things well. So thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Daryl, thank you for your partnership. And Christian.
What a pleasure.
We're so thrilled that we got to know you better and spend time with you. Thank you for your time.
And thank you so much. And if there's anything in the future you all need, just reach out. Definitely. Okay.
We will. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Compassionate Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at CompassionateLeadersCircle.com. Please join us each week as we shine a light on compassionate leaders making a positive impact on their communities and the world.